You're listening to a podcast right now, driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own podcast is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads just like this. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start your new podcast for free today at RSS.com.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and hundreds more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads like this, even with just 10 listeners a month. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start free at RSS.com.
This episode of Social Flight Live is made possible by Avemco Insurance. Mention Social Flight for a 5% insurance discount at Avemco.com, subject to terms and conditions.
Welcome to the Social Flight Live podcast, an audio version of our live show, hosted every Tuesday evening at 8 p.m. Eastern at socialflightlive.com. Social Flight is brought to you by Aspen Avionics, Avidyne, Continental Aerospace Technologies, Lightspeed Aviation, Tempest Aero Group, and Whip Air. And now, here's your host, Jeff Simon.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Social Flight Live. I'm Jeff Simon. We have a fantastic and educational show for you this evening. Mike Bush is here. We're going to talk about maintenance-induced failures, what he's been learning from the data, and what you can do to protect yourself and your flying safety. Before we get started, just a few things. There is some fantastic events going on in Social Flight as the holidays approach. And even though the days are getting shorter and the sun sets a little earlier now, it's a great time to get education. And I recommend that you go there. It is completely free. We have tons of courses where you can go and get wings credit, or if you're a mechanic, get your IA credit or your Aviation Maintenance Technician Award Programs credits. All of it on demand, on your own time, directly coordinated with the FAA. So go to Social Flight and then go to the FAA credit section for that. We also have our Fly to Win Challenge. We just gave away a Lightspeed Delta Zulu headset, and we are giving away another one on December 1st. All you need to do is get the Social Flight mobile app. Go out there and check in, even at your local airport. Once you are entered in to win, do it again, and you then have an opportunity to get more entries in there if you get on our leaderboard. Tonight's broadcast is brought to us by Phillips 66 Lubricants, including the Phillips 66 XC20W50 multi-weight engine oil that I use in my own aircraft, as well as their Victory line of oils with anti-wear additives, anti-rust oil, hydraulic fluids, so much more. Look for some great educational material coming to Social Flight soon from Phillips 66 on lubrication and protecting your engine. There's going to be a lot of that in that section I talked about earlier of FAA credits. Now to tonight's guest. Mike Bush is arguably the best-known airframe and power plant mechanic in general aviation. He founded Savvy Aviation in 2008 to provide aircraft maintenance management and consulting services to thousands of aircraft owners, including pre-buy management, innovative engine monitor analysis, borescope image analysis, and 24/7 breakdown assistance. That's essentially AAA for GA. In addition to Savvy, Mike has authored hundreds of articles and 4 books on aviation ownership and maintenance. I am thrilled to call him a friend and a mentor. Please welcome to Social Flight Live, Mike Bush. There, hey there, go. Sir.
Little delayed reaction after I pushed the button there.
Yeah. Well,
you forgot to mention evangelism and advocacy.
Evangelism, advocacy. Oh God, there's so many things. I don't know what else to list for you, man. You know, one of the things that got my attention in saying that we needed to dedicate another show to having you on, Mike, is the work that you've done recently and an article that you wrote in AOPA. Having to do with maintenance-induced failures. You and I are both wrote some different things having to do with the study that was done. And so I'd like you to talk a little bit about this this study, what we're learning, and then what the kind of the work that you're doing there at Savvy to try to change the world and keep us a little safer, in some cases away from wrenches.
Now, of course, I've been writing and preaching about maintenance-induced failures for decades now, because of my anecdotal experience with maintenance-induced failures. One of the things I do in my copious spare time is expert witness work in air crash litigation. And so I've been exposed to a lot of catastrophic things that happen within minutes or hours after airplanes come out of maintenance. And for a long time, I've been talking about the perils of cylinder work and why we should try to avoid replacing cylinders in the field if we can possibly do that. And just generally, sort of the reliability centered, if it ain't broke, don't fix it kind of philosophy, that the less we mess with the airplanes, the more reliable they are. But the study that you were talking about caught both of our attentions, I think, because I think both of us wrote about it. It came out in February, I think, of this year. It was kind of hot off the press. And it was a study done by a couple of researchers named Scarpazza and Hutter, I think. Scarpazza, I know, was a CFII and a PhD in something elaborate. And Hutter was a medical researcher with, you know, a lot of statistical background and stuff. And they basically, they did this study, and the question that they were trying to ask or trying to answer was, is it true that airplanes are more dangerous right after they come out of maintenance? And we've all sort of had this intuitive feeling that, yeah, they sure are. And you can't trust, you know, when they come out of maintenance, you've got to be on your, you can't really trust them until they've proven themselves. But they wanted to do a study that actually quantified that. And there have been a lot of studies that quantified that in the airlines dating back to the 70s. But this is the first time I'm aware that anybody actually tried to do it for small GA airplanes. So their approach was to scour the NTSB database, and they grabbed 17 years of NTSB accident and serious incident history from the NTSB, and they were trying to quantify how often accidents and serious incidents happen as a function of what they call TSLI, time since last inspection. So when an airplane first comes out of annual, it's got zero TSLI, and then as we continue to fly it, that number grows. So they were looking to try to figure out how often these accidents happen because of some sort of mechanical failure, as opposed to, a pilot-induced kind of thing, a human thing. So they did a study, and they discovered, not surprisingly, that the rate of mechanical failures was pretty high when TSLI was low.
You're listening to a podcast right now, driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own podcast is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads just like this. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start your new podcast for free today at RSS.com.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own is free and easy. Upload an episode, and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and hundreds more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads like this, even with just 10 listeners a month. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start free at RSS.com.
And it decreased as TSLI got higher. But then they took this, they looked at accidents and incidents that were human caused as opposed to machine caused. And they found the same pattern, which kind of seemed weird at first, that the airplane is more likely to have a human caused accident at low TSLI than at high TSLI. And it was like, well, that's a head scratcher. That shouldn't be. And then they figured out that the reason for this was that we don't fly very much. And so a lot of airplanes, personal use airplanes, never get more than maybe 40 or 50 hours TSLI before the 12 months comes around and they have to have another inspection. And for airplanes that do fly a lot, those airplanes typically are subject to 100-hour inspections, because they're usually, the reason they fly a lot is because they're in some kind of commercial service, flight school or something. And so those airplanes never get to more than 100 TSLI by definition, and frequently less. So it was like, well, how are we going to approach the question that we were trying to approach when, you know, when even human caused accidents are heavily biased towards low TSLIs. So they came up with what I thought was a pretty clever idea. They said, instead of looking at absolute numbers, let's look at the ratio. Let's look at the ratio between machine caused accidents and human caused accidents, and see how that ratio varies as a function of TSLI. Mm-hmm. And the hypothesis behind that was that human performance should not care how much time it was since the last inspection. And so the human accident rate should be able to be used as a baseline, and then that against which the machine caused accidents could be compared.
Mike, let me ask you a question about this data. One of the things that can be confusing is that when you look at NTSB reports, it's fairly common to find something where, even if there is a mechanical malfunction of the aircraft, if ultimately the aircraft like had a runway excursion at the end of it, it's the pilot that they blame. And so it could be.
You're saying accidents have mixed causes, that they're not purely human caused, not purely aircraft caused. And it's that's overwhelmingly the case. What they found when they did this study was, well, they started off with a population of something like 27,000 accidents and incidents over the 17 years, and then they whittled it down to Part 91 operations of small airplanes, and they wound up with 16,000. a population of 16,000 roughly accidents. And it turned out that of those 16,000 accidents, 99% were of mixed cause, just like you said. And you know, it's the kind of thing, it says, you know, the engine quit 30 seconds after takeoff. The pilot attempted to turn back to the runway. He got slow and he spun in. Okay. That's a mixed cause accident. And so they said, well, we can't use those in the study. We have to compare purely human caused accidents to purely machine caused accidents. And there were a precious few of those. Out of the 16,000 accidents and incidents, there were only about 150 that were pure, where the NTSB totally blamed it on the machine or right. totally blamed it on the human, where there wasn't a mixed cause.
Which makes you suspicious of the data when you're only dealing with a sample set of 100 now.
Yeah, so it was a very small sample set. That's, you know, my take when I read the paper was they had a really good idea, but the way they did it, the sample set was so small that it was somewhat suspect. The vast overwhelming majority of accidents, 99% of them, were thrown out of the study because they weren't pure. So the results they got were kind of interesting, and I think we should probably discuss them. But I decided that we ought to be able to do better. And so my team is in the process of redoing the Scarpazza and Hutter study, but using AI to analyze the NTSB database, which is something Scarpazza and Hutter didn't do, to try to determine not whether the accident was purely human caused or purely machine caused, because very few of them are pure, but to make an intelligent determination of whether the accident was primarily machine caused. I mean, you know, I think intuitively we would look at an accident like the one I just described, where the engine quit 30 seconds after takeoff and the pilot tried to turn back and crash, as a machine caused accident. You know, if the engine hadn't quit, the accident wouldn't have happened. And the pilot's malfeasance was a contributing factor. You know, and of course, another inescapable flaw in any study like this that there's nothing we can do about is if the engine quit 30 seconds after takeoff and the pilot turned back and made a greaser on the runway, it would never wind up in the NTSB database, so we wouldn't even know about it. So if the pilot did a really good job, the accident is excluded from the study because it's not an accident.
Right.
It's a traumatic event. It requires a change of underwear, but it doesn't get into the NTSB database.
And I think that's one of the challenges in all of this, because when we're only studying accidents, we're only looking at the worst outcomes. And the average viewer of tonight's show, to the average general aviation pilot, their concern, certainly they're concerned about accidents, but reality is, what they're really on edge for, rightly so, is am I going to have an engine failure or something minor or middle of the road? Is, you know, right after I got my mags back after a 500-hour inspection and they all got mounted, am I going to lose a mag during flight, on the first flight? Am I going to have something else that starts happening? What kind of information do you have access to, even through Savvy, to try to get more information that maybe isn't accident related?
Well, you know, that's a difficult problem. We are doing a bunch of AI work now to try to get aircraft maintenance records.
You're listening to a podcast right now, driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own podcast is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads just like this. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start your new podcast for free today at RSS.com.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own is free and easy. Upload an episode, and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and hundreds more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads like this, even with just 10 listeners a month. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start free at RSS.com.
Analyzed by AI. And again, the reason for AI is because this is stuff a human could do, but it would, you know, take 1,000 years. The AI is really fast, you know. It's probably not quite as good as we are yet, although it's getting close, but it's really fast. And so, you know, it would not be reasonable to ask a human to go through 16,000 NTSB reports and classify them. That would take an army. But it's easy to ask AI to do that. And so that's why that's the direction that we're leaning in. And look, you have a catastrophic engine failure on takeoff. There's one outcome that says the airplane crashed and wound up in the NTSB database. And the other outcome is the pilot did a heroic job and put it down on the runway and nobody was the wiser, didn't get on the FAA's radar screen or anything. But the human's performance is still going to probably be TSLI invariant. So if you say half the engine failures got into the NTSB database and the other half didn't, it's probably, pilots probably aren't quite that good. It's probably more than half got into the NTSB database, but then that's an invariant factor. You can still analyze the shape of the curve in terms of what the risk is an hour after annual, 2 hours after annual, 5 hours after annual, and so on. And even if half of the cases never made it into the NTSB database, the shape of the curve would still be pretty much the same. So I think it's a worthwhile analysis. No analysis is perfect. But I think the Skarpats and Hutter study used such a small sample size that and such an unusual sample, you know, that was those very oddball cases where the NTSB attributed 100% to the pilot or 100% to the machine, which is not that common, that I think it would be really worthwhile to redo the study with a more expansive definition of what a machine-caused accident is, and so that the sample size is an order of magnitude or two larger than what their study did. So anyway, I think the study is very useful, and we probably should talk about what they found, but I'm a little suspicious that the numbers may not be all that reliable simply because the sample size was so small. And I think we can do better.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what they found in the study. And then I do want to get to talking about what owners can actually do following maintenance, because clearly that's a very important part of both your and my career work. And we know there's a problem there, whether a study tells us or not. But let's talk about that. What did they actually come out with? Because studies like this that are scientifically recognized and do result have to do with catastrophic, you know, incidents, do get people's attention to change rules. That's a key thing. That's more important than when we tell people that things go bad, but no one gets hurt. So what did the study find?
Yeah, you don't have the ability to put the curve up on the screen, do you? You have it handy?
I do not have that right handy.
I've got it sitting on my screen, but I don't think I can share my screen.
Oh, I can. I think you can share your screen, actually.
Oh, really?
Or send it to me and I'll bring it up.
Let's just talk about it. I'm not sufficiently multi-threaded that I can send it to you and talk at the same time. but basically what they were, as I said, they analyzed the ratio of purely machine caused accidents versus purely human caused accidents, where they used the human caused accidents as a baseline. And what they found was that during the first hour that the airplane is out of inspection, it was, I think the number was about 34%, 33.8 or something like that, more likely to have a machine caused accident than a human caused accident. Which seemed like a pretty amazing number, because, you know, we've always been taught that 80% of the accidents are pilot caused and 20% are machine caused. A lot of studies come up with numbers something like that. Sometimes 75, 25, but the overwhelming majority of accidents are human caused. But what they found was that when the airplane first came out of inspection, it was roughly 34% more likely that it would have an accident caused by a failure of the machine than one caused by a failure of the pilot. And then the second hour, it dropped to 30%. And then the hour after that, it dropped to 20-something percent. And by the time you were 30 or 31 hours out of inspection, the two were on, were at parity. You were equally likely to have a machine caused or a pilot caused accident. Yep. And then as the time since inspection continued to increase, the incidence of machine caused accidents continued to decrease, and it reached the lowest point, where the machine caused accidents were at their lowest compared to the human baseline. Out
just before
190 hours, something like that.
Yeah, just before maintenance.
And then after 190 hours, it gradually started rising back up again, and it didn't get back to parity until almost 400 hours.
Yeah. I mean, ultimately,
there aren't not a lot of airplanes that
it sends the message that the safest flight you make is the one to get your annual done.
Probably so. The ferry flight to the shop.
So good point. So Mike, let's talk about it.
Think about what this means. If these numbers are right, and like I say, we're working on redoing the numbers with a much larger sample size to see, you know, I'm sure we'll have a curve that's roughly the same shape, but I'm not sure that it'll reach its minimum at the same number of hours and stuff. But if the results of their study is accurate or roughly accurate and it extrapolates to a larger sample size, it says that for optimum safety, we should be inspecting these airplanes every 200 or 300 hours, not every 100 hours or 50 hours or whatever. The inspection adds a significant element of risk, and we really shouldn't be reinspecting the airplanes until there's some evidence that not inspecting them makes them more dangerous.
Right.
And so the inspection interval, based on this study, our inspection intervals are wildly too short.
Right.
Now, the amazing part of this is exactly what Conrad Waddington found out in the 40s in World War II. This is exactly what Nolan and Heap found at United Airlines in the late 60s, you know, when they're dealing with transport airplanes. And here we're doing a study on little GA airplanes and finding exactly the same thing. We call it the Waddington effect, because Waddington, I think, was the first guy. He was a scientist back with the Royal Air Force in England back in the early 40s. And he was dealing with the maintenance of B-25s. There's just this fundamental truth that says that the airplanes get more reliable the longer they go without a mechanic touching them. And not infinitely long, but, you know, in the case of Waddington back in World War II, that they had these airplanes coming in for maintenance every 50 hours, kind of like we usually do, right? And every 50 hours, the airplanes would come out of maintenance, and the number of squawks would just go through the roof, and then they would gradually diminish, and finally 50 hours came around, they went back in the shop. And Waddington, who headed up a team of scientists working for the RAF, said, hey, you know, the maintenance is doing positive harm to the aircraft. Let's not do it so often, and let's do less of, when it does come into the shop, let's do a lot less preventive maintenance on it. Just, you know, kind of leave it alone. It's basically a reliable machine, and we keep messing with it and making it unreliable. And yeah. So that's, you know, that same lesson is what the guys at United Airlines found when they were studying the Boeing's, actually the DC-8s at United Airlines, and they came up with this thing called reliability center maintenance that says, hey, let's not do that. And now this study is looking at little airplanes and coming up with exactly the same conclusion.
So, Mike, let me ask you, I mean, you've got decades upon decades of experience. You and I do a lot of work together. We see the same kinds of things, I think. But I'm very interested in your opinion first on the kind of maintenance that matters to happen on a regular basis that we've learned makes a difference, like borescope inspections for valves, versus the type of maintenance that often causes more trouble than good, like taking everything apart just to look on something that probably only didn't even get a lot of hours. What are your thoughts on first, what are the key things that you think really do matter to happen on a regular, on a good, regular, frequent schedule, at, like borescoping?
Well, okay. You have to separate inspection from maintenance. I mean, and under the regs, inspection is considered maintenance, but it's a very special kind of maintenance. Inspection is looking at stuff, and sometimes measuring stuff, but not fixing stuff. And there's a science to how often we should inspect. And there's a lot of stuff written in RCM literature, having to do with the PF interval and so on, which we can talk about. But the general gist of reliability center maintenance is we should do more inspection and less preventive maintenance. A lot less preventive maintenance. It's the preventive maintenance. I mean, first of all, preventive maintenance is as opposed to corrective maintenance. Preventive maintenance is maintenance whose intention is to try to prevent a failure from happening. Corrective maintenance is to fix something that has failed. And obviously, okay, when things fail, we have to do corrective maintenance. That's not, you know, that's not negotiable. But the real issue is preventive maintenance. How much preventive maintenance should we do? And the RCM researchers said, in order to decide how much preventive maintenance we should do, we first of all need to consider the consequences of the failures that we're trying to prevent. And if the consequences of the failure that we're trying to prevent is an acceptable consequence, if it's not going to get somebody hurt or killed or stuck somewhere forever where they're stranded, then we shouldn't try to prevent it, because the act of trying to prevent it creates risk of failure. And so, you know, an engine failure is an unacceptable failure. So we have to do whatever it takes to try to prevent that. But the failure of your number two comm radio is an acceptable failure.
Right. I think one of the challenges, though, Mike, is inspection is often invasive, even though we don't want it to be. Something like Borescope might be simple, but there was an accident Brian Schiff and I were talking about on the last program of Cockpit to Cowl that resulted in an accident that was an inspection and work that had been done where squat switches got disconnected as part of what you test and didn't get reconnected mm-hmm. properly. And, mm-hmm. and or in this case,
I can't tell you how many times we've seen airplanes come out of inspection and have a failure because somebody disconnected an oil hose and put it back on finger tight. And then the Snap-on truck came by, or the phone rang, or a customer came by and they didn't tighten it. You know, tremendous number of the maintenance induced failures that we have are distraction induced, really. Distractions are like the bane of aviation maintenance.
Well,
and most of our GA maintenance shops are distraction rich environments.
You think? Yeah. It's true. And any form you mentioned, obviously we're talking about inspection and how that can cause issues, even though inspection is a different form of maintenance. I keep on my desk this flashlight. People who have seen the show with me before have seen this flashlight before, probably, but this is a flashlight that was wedged in a center console of a Cessna, where a cable rubbed dramatically mm-hmm. through it, ate a whole lot of aluminum out of this, just almost went through the case.
Yep.
I'm still waiting for the mechanic to ask for it back. But that's a case of, you know, tools get left behind, things happen. And so I guess it's not always just the idea of when do you inspect, but I mean, let's turn around. What can owners do? What are your recommendations to people watching tonight?
This episode is brought to you by Spreaker, the platform responsible for a rapidly spreading condition known as podcast brain. Symptoms include buying microphones you don't need, explaining RSS feeds to confused relatives, and saying things like, "Sorry, I can't talk right now, I'm editing audio." If this sounds familiar, you're probably already a podcaster. The good news is Spreaker makes the whole process simple. You record your show, upload it once, and Spreaker distributes it everywhere people listen. Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and about a dozen apps your cousin swears are the next big thing. Even better, Spreaker helps you monetize your show with ads, meaning your podcast might someday pay for, well, more microphones. Start your show today at Spreaker.com. Spreaker, because if you're going to talk to yourself for an hour, you might as well publish it.
Right. About what they can do on the receiving end of this. They can't change the legislation themselves. We can't go to, it would be wonderful to go to biennial reviews instead of annual reviews, but inspections. But what do you advise people as to how to keep themselves safe?
The first thing I advise is not on the receiving end. It's making sure mechanics don't take stuff apart that they don't have to take apart, and don't do preventive maintenance that they don't have to do. Just because the book says you're supposed to do it doesn't mean you should do it. Mm-hmm. The worst thing you can do to an airplane is maintain it by the book, but that's how mechanics are taught. That's how mechanics are programmed. So it's kind of up to aircraft owners to say no to a lot of stuff like that.
Let's talk about that. Let's narrow down on that one for a second, because that's really important. Aircraft come from the manufacturer with recommended service intervals. When you should be overhauling components. I know on my own Bonanza, it has a time to overhaul the sector, the main landing gearbox. I've never done it because you can know.
In my airplane, there are 250 plus items like that in the manual of stuff you're supposed to do at certain times, at certain numbers of hours, certain numbers of months, you know. And that's just like the worst idea in the world. Very, very little of that stuff should be done.
How do you determine what aside from just signing up for Savvy, how do you in getting your personal advice and those of the people working for you, how does someone determine what should be done and what shouldn't be done? Because some things, right, we do know need to be done, like inspecting magnetos, but other things, like taking a prop off at a certain time.
So you bring up a good point, and it is true that we need to take magnetos apart periodically, but the real important part is why. What reliability centered maintenance says is it creates a set of principles, and they're very common sense principles, and they're very easy to understand. And if you just follow those principles, it'll put you on the right path. And one of the principles is we should not try to prevent acceptable failures. So, you know, the failure of a number two comm radio is an acceptable failure. So we don't pull the comm radio out every so many hours and send it into Garmin. We just don't do that. We run it until it fails because the failure is acceptable. One example is we still have some airplanes out there that actually use vacuum pumps to run gyros, right? That's fewer and fewer now because we're gradually replacing those gyros with Edahars and stuff, but. The vacuum pumps are the dry vacuum pumps are something I don't think they should have ever been certified in the first place, because they have the world's most intractable failure mode. They work perfectly right up until the millisecond that they don't, and then they erupt in a cloud of graphite dust and fail instantaneously with no warning. And they can do that after 10 hours. They can do that after 2,000 hours. And there's no way of predicting when they're going to do that, because all it takes is one little carbon granule in the wrong place in the wrong time to break a vein and cause the pump to go belly up. So Is the failure of a vacuum pump an acceptable failure? Well, if it's the only thing that keeps your attitude indicator going and keeps the dirty side down when you're flying in a cloud or at night, it's not an acceptable failure. It's an unacceptable failure. So what do we do about that? We can inspect that vacuum pump all we want, and we're still not going to prevent it from failing. So the only answer is you have to have two vacuum pumps, or you have to have a backup electric gyro or some backup, some redundancy. And once you have the redundancy, then the failure becomes acceptable. And the basic principle about acceptable failures is we don't try to prevent them. We run the item to failure. That's the optimum strategy for acceptable failure. So that's the first principle of RCM is don't try to prevent failures that are acceptable. And make as many failures acceptable as you can by having sufficient redundancy in the airplane. That's why we have, you know, two GPSs and two comm radios. I got, I don't know, five GPSs if I count my iPhone, my iPad, everything. We have GPS redundancy up the gazoo. You know, we can have three GPS failures and it's still, we're still know where we are. That's the height of redundancy.
One of
The first principle is don't try to prevent acceptable failures. The second principle is do maintenance on condition anytime you can, as opposed to doing it on a fixed timetable. And on condition means you don't mess with it on a particular timetable. What you do is inspect it repetitively and only mess with it when the inspection indicates that there's that it has degraded to the point that you need to do something about it. A perfect example would be aircraft tires. Okay. If somebody said, we want you to change your tires every 300 landings, nobody would do that. I mean, that's stupid. Because you can look at the tire and you know when you have to change it. We change tires on condition. We don't change them every 300 landings. But these manuals are full of things that say do X every Y hours or do X every Y months, and that's like changing tires every 300 landings. It's dumb. If you condition, we need to do stuff only on condition. Do maintenance only when it's demonstrably necessary.
One of the things I want to get your thoughts on that I've observed as an issue having to do with maintenance-induced failures and increased risk is limiting the scope of the work to only what's actually needing to be done, only what's actually failed. I see this frequently with people with cylinders, where one cylinder has a problem that actually legitimately needs to be repaired. And that somehow translates into, this is a really good time, I'm just going to pull all six cylinders or all four cylinders. And it seems like there's a disconnect between either the owner or the mechanic's idea that doing them all will improve safety and economics.
In my experience, it's almost always the mechanic.
That it actually puts the risk dramatically higher.
Absolutely. And in my experience, it's almost always the mechanic. The mechanic says, hey, you know, we have to change the number two cylinder for some reason. And of course, most of the time that they say that, you don't have to, because you can lap the valve or do something, not remove the cylinder. But he says, I have to drop the induction and the exhaust and stuff on the left side of the engine while we have it all down. Wouldn't it be convenient to just replace all three cylinders on that side of the engine? It's kind of a mechanic based thing. And all of it is based on the fact that mechanics are not taught that what they do is risky. It's a fundamental education problem that we have with mechanics. If a surgeon said, hey, we need to take out your appendix, but while we're in there, why don't we do some other stuff too? That nobody would do that, okay? Because everybody knows surgery is risky. Well, mechanics are the surgeons of aviation. They take stuff apart, you know, and But they're not trained the way medical people are to make risk-benefit analyses to say, is what I'm about to do, is the benefit clearly outweigh the risk? And have we taken all the risks into account? And, you know, taking one cylinder off is moderately risky. Taking all of the cylinders off, even one side of the engine, is immensely risky. It increases the risk dramatically. Because when you unbolt all the cylinders on one side of the engine, there's basically nothing holding the engine together anymore. And, you know, bearings can shift and stuff. You know, one of the craziest things that that I used to hear all the time is owner brings an airplane in for what he thinks is going to be a routine oil change. The mechanic cuts open the oil filter and sees some ferrous metal in the filter. And he says, "Oh my, I think maybe your cam is coming apart. Maybe we ought to pull a cylinder off and take a look." Now, that is the craziest idea in the world. Why? Because nobody ever fell out of the sky because a cam was coming apart. But lots of people have fallen out of the sky because a mechanic removed and replaced a cylinder. So why would you do something that has essentially no risk? You know, why would you do something risky in order to deal with something that is not risky? Cam and lifter stuff, like I say, I always characterize it as it's not a safety of flight item, it's a safety of wallet item. It's expensive, but it's not dangerous. But cylinder removal is dangerous. And
yeah,
most mechanics don't really think about the danger involved. I've been preaching about this stuff for years, and I've got, you know, a large photo collection of airplanes that crashed within a couple of hours after cylinder work. It's very risky, but mechanics aren't trained to think in terms of the risk of what they're doing. And risk is a function of invasiveness, like you were talking about.
Yeah.
So in inspection that's minimally invasive, like sticking a borescope in a spark plug hole, is, you know, there's no way you can really make the airplane fall out of the sky by doing that. But the more you take stuff apart to inspect it, the more the risk you're introducing into the equation.
Yeah. Mike, let me give you as a mechanic, my own personal like little list and get your thoughts on what you think. I in my experience, the types of things that for me are incredibly important to do are, like, as you mentioned, borescope inspections, oil filter inspections, oil analysis, mag 500 hours, because we know they wear, we know they can cause trouble. Not a whole lot more on that list is really telling it, really, like, what's your safety of flight?
Well, let's talk about two of the things you mentioned specifically. Let's talk about borescope inspections briefly.
Let me add one, and that's the service bulletin, the 388C wobble check for like homing so that they don't stick valves. I'm going to add that one to my list. Yeah.
Let's talk about borescope inspections for a minute. The main thing that we look at when we do borescope inspections in terms of stuff that could get us hurt, what we're looking for, are exhaust valve, heat distress of exhaust valves. There's almost nothing else in a cylinder that could get you hurt as long as nobody tries to remove it. You know, you could have all kinds of corrosion pitting on the cylinder walls, engine's going to burn more oil than it would otherwise, but it's not going to get you hurt. Exhaust valve failure can get you hurt. So that's probably the most important thing we look for when we do a borescope inspection. So then the question is, how often should we be doing borescope inspections? And the answer is that we need to get a handle on how much lead time the borescope inspection gives you before the valve fails. This is what's known as the PF interval in reliability center maintenance, where P is the point of first detectability, where you can first detect that something is starting to deteriorate. And F is when it actually fails, when the valve gets swallowed and the cylinder shuts down and your four-cylinder engine becomes a three-cylinder engine and you start looking for a place to put the airplane. So the question is, how much lead time is there between the time you first can see an exhaust valve starting to go bad and when it actually fails? And there have been a lot of studies about that. I think we've probably done more work on that than anybody. And, I don't have a precise number, and there's never such thing as a precise number. But my sense is that the number is somewhere between 100 hours and 200 hours. From the first time you start to see an uneven heat pattern on a valve to the time it's actually going to get swallowed.
That makes sense, but I want to add to that my interpretation is it's more like 50 to 100 if instead of failure, instead of the PF curve, you're looking to catch it where you can repair it.
Okay, well, that you make a good point. But anyway, let me just finish the thought. So let's say we knew for sure that the point of detectability was exactly 100 hours before failure. Obviously, it's never going to be exact anything, but let's say we did a big study and we determined that we can start seeing an exhaust valve failure 100 hours before it actually functionally fails. So how often do you have to inspect it? Well, if you inspected it every 100 hours, you'd be skating on very thin ice. You'd catch some of them before they fail, but you couldn't be confident in catching them all. So there's sort of a general guideline in RCM that says we should inspect it about one half the PF interval. So if we know that the thing gives us 100 hours lead time, we should inspect every 50 hours. And that way we can have a very, very high confidence that we're going to catch the problem before it bites us.
This episode is brought to you by Spreaker, the platform responsible for a rapidly spreading condition known as podcast brain. Symptoms include buying microphones you don't need, explaining RSS feeds to confused relatives, and saying things like, "Sorry, I can't talk right now, I'm editing audio." If this sounds familiar, you're probably already a podcaster. The good news is Spreaker makes the whole process simple. You record your show, upload it once, and Spreaker distributes it everywhere people listen. Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and about a dozen apps your cousin swears are the next big thing. Even better, Spreaker helps you monetize your show with ads, meaning your podcast might someday pay for, well, more microphones. Start your show today at Spreaker.com. Spreaker, because if you're going to talk to yourself for an hour, you might as well publish it.
Now, you actually added a little wrinkle to it that says, how often do we have to inspect so that we catch it early enough that we don't have to pull the cylinder, that we can lap the valve in place? It's not too far gone to lap. And again, my general sense is that if we did a borescope inspections every 50 hours, we would catch them early enough. And we actually, we have almost 200,000 borescope images in our repository now. We've done a bunch of studies on them, including about 9,000 exhaust valves, by the way. And what we found was that the borescope inspections are catching the valves at early stage where they're still in good shape to be lapped about 85% of the time. That only about 15% of the time are they caught when they're at mid stage or late stage, where the cylinder might have to come off because the valve is too far gone to lap. So that's important information. And again, that's the sort of thing that's really never been studied before, because nobody's ever collected 200,000 borescope images before. This is all really interesting stuff.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on mags?
Yeah, let's talk about mags for a minute. Magneto is the reason we have to take mags apart every 500 hours. And I'm a strong believer in doing that, and you obviously are too, is because there's no good way to determine the condition of a magneto without taking it apart. It's not like an engine where we can check the filter and we can stick a borescope in and look around, except that there's no way we can assess the condition of a magneto without taking it apart. It's one of those very rare things that you can't maintain on condition. You have to take it apart. There aren't many things on airplanes like that, but mags are one of those very few cases.
And it's aware of.
And it's got a lot of breakable stuff in there. It's got a lot of plastic, you know. It's got stuff that wears out. It's got carbon brushes. It's got felts that are lubricated and they dry out. So, you know, and actually I think we'll be a lot better off once we get rid of all the mags. You know, we're getting rid of the gyros. We need to start getting rid of the mags, because they're just sort of a somewhat intractable item to deal with from a maintenance standpoint. But the only way you can determine the condition of a mag is to take it apart. So we believe strongly in doing a 500 hour inspection, 500 hour IRAN.
Yeah.
Now, Continental has a service bulletin that says they want you to overhaul mags every 4 calendar years. Now that's stupid. Okay, and nobody should do that. The Continental can say that all they want, but it's just dumb. Why is it dumb? Because there's almost nothing in magnetos that deteriorates with calendar time. The only thing I know of in a magneto that deteriorates with calendar time is the condenser. And condensers usually last about 10 years and they have date codes on them. But, and you don't have to take the mag apart to determine how old the condenser is. But mags do wear with operating hours. And yeah, we don't have a good way to determine what their condition is without taking them apart. They just don't have any like inspection ports where you can, like I said, stick a borescope inside and look around. You can't do that with a magneto.
Yeah.
So we have to take them apart. It's unfortunate.
Right.
And there aren't too many things on the airplanes that are like that. That have to be taken apart periodically to inspect them. But mags are kind of a special case. Now, there's another interesting little thing about mags. We have two of them, right? So you could make the argument that says failure of a magneto is an acceptable failure because we have two of them. We have redundancy. It's like having two vacuum pumps. So why don't we just run the mags to failure? And that's actually looks good on paper, but in practice it doesn't work that well.
No,
when magnetos have nasty ways of failing that make the engine go berserk, and almost no pilot has the presence of mind when an engine goes berserk to say, let me try turning off a mag and see if it gets better.
Right.
People don't want to turn things off when the engine's going berserk.
Right, even though that can save the engine.
We're
approaching the end of time, but I do want to ask you also about, before we talk about one last topic, about valve wobble check for light homings. Because when we think about valve burning, we're usually thinking about Continentals. Light homings.
Yeah, we actually have some statistics on that from our recent study. Continental burn valves about 2.5 times as often as Lycomings do. And I mean, for years, we've always said, you know, Continentals burn valves like homing stick valves. And now we have like hard evidence that that's true. Continentals burn valves a lot more often than Lycomings do. But Continentals almost never stick valves. Lycomings stick valves, but don't burn valves very often.
So for sticking valves, what are your thoughts on doing the SB388 wobble check for to make sure that that, because that seems incredibly important. I'm a big champion of that.
It's interesting. I've had conversations with Paul New about that. Because he used to maintain a lot of Lycoming powered airplanes. And he said, he started doing the wobble test on the airplanes, and they almost always flunk. And so he just stopped doing that. He just said, you know, instead of doing the wobble test, I'm just going to ream the guides.
Now, well, that's fine too.
Irrespective of the wobble, I'm just gonna clean out the guides and.
But that's fine too. That's a preventive maintenance task. If you're going to go, for anyone listening, there's a specific reamer you can use. You don't have to take off a cylinder. You can do something called the rope trick. You can drop the valve. You can clean it out. You can put it back in. It's not it's medium invasiveness, but. Either way,
it was just more trouble to do the wobble measurement than it was to just drop the valve and ream it. So I thought that was kind of an interesting approach.
I think that's a great idea.
But it is a huge problem. It is a huge problem with Lycomings. So that they are very, and it's true of all Lycomings. They're just very vulnerable to valve sticking. Something that Continentals are not. Continentals are vulnerable to valve burning.
Right.
Neither one is good. Both of them can cause a cylinder to shut down.
So Mike, before we go, I want to talk about another aspect of this. We've talked about safety, but the reality is a lot of the work that you're doing at Savvy has saved people an unbelievable amount of money and downtime for their aircraft by focusing on only maintaining what needs to be maintained and managing risk. Managing that risk also translates into managing their wallet. Do you want to tell?
Right, and again, that's something the airlines found out in the late 60s and early 70s when they started moving over to a reliability-centered maintenance philosophy. They discovered that not only were the airplanes a lot more reliable and spent a lot less time in the shop and more time on the line, but they saved a mountain of money by doing less preventive maintenance. So as far as I know, nobody'd ever done a study about that for small airplanes. And we thought that would be an interesting thing to study, but it's easy to figure out what owners spend on maintenance. It's hard to figure out what they don't spend, you know? So, We actually, back in January of this year, we had our software engineering guys add a new feature to the ticket system that Savvy uses to manage the maintenance on all of its airplanes. You know, we deal with like 6,500 airplanes, and we use this online ticket system to keep track of all of them. And so we added a feature where the account managers, when they said no to something that the shop wanted to do, which we do a lot, would actually log that and say the shop wanted to do X, we said no, and saying no saved the owner X dollars. So we actually started to log savings. And this only started happening in February that we had this capability. And it took a long time to get the account managers to actually use it. And there's still some that aren't using it. We're still nudging and cajoling and stuff. But in the first 6 months, they actually logged $750,000 in stuff that the shops wanted to do and we said no. And My best guess, kind of looking at the adoption curve, is that we only actually logged about half of the actual savings because the account managers were kind of slow to pick this up. So that would be about $1.5 million in 6 months. So annualized, that'd be about $3 million a year of saved maintenance cost. So I did an analysis. This is pretty early on. I'm hoping that in 2026, when all of the managers have all of this stuff in their muscle memory and we're doing it on a very regular basis, that we'll have a bigger, more reliable sample set to analyze. But I did some analysis on this first 6 months of stuff that we captured. And it was kind of interesting. The savings ranged from, you know, little $100, $200 things. We told the managers not to even bother to log anything under $100. Up to three or four where we saved the owner $40,000-$50,000 because the shop wanted to have the engine overhauled, and we said no, it doesn't need to be overhauled. I think you were managing one of those where
I've had a few dollar savings in some of those. Yeah, we've had people that had one cylinder problem and shop wanted to do all of them. We've had people wanted to pull the entire engine for
We see a lot of this stuff where you know, a mechanics will find a little metal in the filter and they'll just instantly say, the engine's got to be overhauled. And that's just kind of laziness, you know, and because they don't want to take the time to try to figure out where the metal came from and whether it's something that this case really needs to be split to solve. I think you were working on one of them. It was a Continental engine, and we found a few lifters that were bad.
Yes. I want to be careful, though, not to just point at the mechanics, because I will say I come across many owners that seem to be driven to do major work because they believe the result of the major work will be a safer aircraft.
Yeah.
And so a lot of times I've come across where it's not necessarily the shop. The shop's sort of saying, well, you could do this, you could do that. And the owner's sort of kind of pushing like, well, you know, we're at 2,000 hours almost. And
of course, there was this great study that we wound up doing. It was, I think that we did the study in 2009. It was 5 years worth of NTSB data where we tracked engine failure accidents and as a function of how much time was on the engine. And it turned out that almost all of the engine failure accidents occurred with engines that were very young. Typically in the first year, if you're going to have a catastrophic engine failure, it's almost always going to be in the first year after the engine was built, rebuilt, or overhauled.
Yeah.
The risk is overwhelmingly infant mortality. Very little evidence of any kind of age-related safety issues. And there's really good data on that.
Yeah.
And of course, that's the same thing that is true in the turbine world too, that the engine failures are almost all infant mortality things, unless a bird flies into it or something. You know, we have things like unreported prop strikes, but those are kind of weird cases.
Yeah. Well, Mike, I hope you'll come back on again. We're out of our time, but this is a fascinating subject. We could go for hours and days, and so.
Who sets these time limits anyway, Jeff?
I know. These shows should be
like 3 hours. Yeah. we never ever run out of things to talk about.
Not at all. I hope you'll come back. We'll do it again, and we'll dive into a little more detail on some of these.
Okay.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Mike.
You bet.
Take care.
It's fun. It's always
Thanks.
Fun.
And thanks to all of you as well.
I think you want me to drop off now, right? You're supposed to give me a cue.
I think you can control your. I can't control your camera, sir.
Bye, everybody.
Bye. And thanks to all of you for joining us here on Social Flight Live, for taking time out of your evening again. We'll be back next Tuesday, that's November 11th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, with this very special Cockpit to Cowl show, where you can register for that show I do with Brian Schiff. It's Cockpit, the number 2, and the word cowl, cockpit2cowl.com. And we are going to take a slew of questions and answer them. And that's going to include some of the questions you guys posted this evening on this show. We'll go question by question, get as many in as we can. It's going to be a really fun show. So please join us on Cockpit to Cowl next Tuesday, November 11th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, 5 p.m. Pacific. And then on the following week, November 18th at 8 p.m. here on Social Flight Live, we have a fantastic show, the third installment of our show with astronaut, air racer, test pilot, Hoot Gibson. Hoot's going to come back, and we are going to finish out his story talking about setting records, engineering aircraft, some amazing stories for this truly, truly amazing individual. So please don't miss that show. Tuesday, November 18th, we'll be back here for that show. So with that, again, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it and everything that you all do for General Aviation, as well as joining us here on the show. Check out socialflight.com, and we'll be back with you next week. Until next time, I'm Jeff Simon for Social Flight. Blue skies.